Well, I want to start off by talking about suffering. You know what one of the worst things is when you're a child? One of the worst feelings is that moment when you realize you've got a splinter in your foot and you're going to need to get a needle to extricate it. And the suffering of that, the idea of the suffering you have to go through in order to have that splinter taken out, is so bad that you just keep it at arm's length. When I was a child, I spent a lot of time running around barefoot. We were always out and about running around. And, you know, you tread on thorns, you tread on sharp sticks, and you get splinters. I can remember really distinctly once getting a splinter and seeing it in my foot and knowing that one's not going to come out. That's going to be something I'm going to have to tell my mum about. And then she's going to get out the tweezers and the needles and the TCP. I don't think people use TCP anymore. TCP disinfectant. And she's going to lie me down and she's going to have my foot up and she's going to jab away at it for hours and it's going to be the absolute worst. And so I'm just not going to tell her about it. And I knew that was inevitable. I was going to have to get to that point where actually mum was going to have to jab it out. But I was not willing to face that suffering. And so I held it at arm's length, and I just said, oh, no, it's coming, it'll come out on its own. So I went to bed. The next day, woke up, and it was getting pink, getting itchy, getting infected. But still, the thought of lying down and having it jabbed at by a pin and all these kind of things was just so bad in my head, I thought, no, it's still okay. I'll just deal with it. I'll deal with the discomfort. I'll deal with the itchiness. I'm not going to do anything about it. Keep the suffering at arm's length. The next day, it was even worse. I could barely put any weight on it. It was really hard to put my shoe on because it was so painful. And I walked around sort of on the side of my foot like that. And one of five children, you can get away with being a bit different for a bit and your parents won't notice there's anything. You can kind of, you know, be sitting down when they come in at that one point and my brother's breaking something, so they're looking at him, not me. But after a while, they notice, you know what? Michael's not right. He's not walking right. What's wrong with your foot? And then the moment has come. I have to admit, there's a splinter, and then out come the needles, out come the tweezers, out comes the needle disinfected in boiling water and the TCP, and out comes the jabbing, and then comes the suffering. But it's such an instinct, isn't it, to put off suffering. If we know there's going to be suffering coming, we will hold it at arm's length for as long as we possibly can. It's a human instinct to avoid suffering and to keep it at arm's length as much as we possibly can, whether you're a child with a splinter or whether you're a grown-up making choices about lifestyle or career. Our whole culture, our whole instinct is designed to seek comfort and to avoid suffering. And the ultimate suffering is death. That's the ultimate thing that we're keeping at arm's length as a society, aren't we? It's just that instinct. So just as we start off, just consider, what things have you done today simply to avoid suffering? To avoid discomfort? What little things have you done when it's really hot? But what about in your life? What big choices have you made in your life simply to avoid suffering or to gain comfort? If we're honest, most of the motivation behind our big choices are to gain comfort and to avoid suffering, aren't they? One of the biggest existential questions that people have, you know, why is there suffering? It doesn't sit right with us that there is this thing called suffering in our life. But as we come to this book of 1 Peter, we see Peter talking about suffering in a very different kind of way. It's a big theme in this letter, suffering. And he's come at it again and again and again in this letter that he's written to these Christians. These Christians are scattered all over the place. In chapter 1, verse 6, he's told them to suffer grief in all kinds of trials. He says suffering is about to hit you quite hard. In chapter 2, verses 19 to 21, there's a little section there where he says, it is commendable if someone bears up under the pain of unjust suffering because they are conscious of God. And he ties it to Jesus and he says, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example. Then last week we saw Peter say in chapter 3, verse 14,
even if you suffer for what is right, you are blessed. And the theme carries on in the letter. As we get into chapter 4, he talks about the Christian living a life and actually rejoicing in suffering because you're participating in the sufferings of Christ. So it's a huge theme in the letter. And throughout the letter, Peter's trying to get Christians to see the whole topic of suffering differently. But now we come to our passage. So if you haven't done so already, I'm conscious I haven't told you where we're going yet, but 1 Peter 3, so that's the wrong read. We're doing 1 Peter 3, verse 17 through to 4:6. But it's on that page, page 1219. So do turn that up. Page 1219, we're going to read 1 Peter 3, verse 17 through to chapter 4, verse 6. But I'm raising that issue of suffering before we come to our reading, because this is one of the trickiest passages in the whole Bible. And it's, Martin Luther calls it the most obscure passage in the New Testament. As I was reading in preparation for this, one commentator called Hendrickson said there are 180 different legitimate ways to interpret this passage. So we're going to start off with number one and go through, no we're not. And so there's 180 different rabbit holes we could get lost down here. And so we're going to take a top-down view. We're going to skate over quite a lot of things. There's going to be lots of questions you're going to ask that we're not going to answer. But I'm starting off with a bigger introduction talking about suffering, because that's the line we're going to take through this passage. And I want you to see why before we read the passage. Have a look at chapter 3, verse 17. Peter says this: "It is better, if it is God's will, to suffer for doing good than for evil." And then beginning of verse 18, "For Christ died for sins." Our suffering, Christ's suffering, connected. Okay? And then turn over, chapter 4, verse 1. He goes through this long thing about Christ's suffering, and then 4, verse 1, "Therefore, since Christ suffered in his body, arm yourselves also with the same attitude," the same way of thinking. So that's the route we're taking through this. There's going to be lots of things that we're going to wonder about, lots of things that we would have a long discussion about if we were having a Bible study, but because it's a sermon, we're just going to skate over it, and I just want you to see why I'm taking that angle of suffering through this passage where lots of other themes are going to pop up. Okay? So that's going to be our route, the suffering route through this passage. But now let's read it. I'm going to read 1 Peter 3, verse 17 through to 4, verse 6. "It is better, if it is God's will, to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. For Christ died for sins once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. He was put to death in the body, but made alive by the Spirit, through whom also he went and preached to the spirits in prison, who disobeyed long ago when God waited patiently in the days of Noah while the ark was being built. In it, only a few people, eight in all, were saved through water. And this water symbolizes baptism that now saves you also. Not the removal of dirt from the body, but the pledge of a good conscience towards God. It saves you by the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is at God's right hand with angels, authorities, and powers in submission to him. Therefore, since Christ suffered in his body, arm yourselves also with the same attitude, because he who has suffered in his body is done with sin. As a result, he does not live the rest of his earthly life for evil human desires, but rather for the will of God. For you've spent enough time in the past doing what pagans choose to do, living in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and detestable idolatry. They think it strange that you do not plunge with them into the same flood of dissipation, and they heap abuse on you. But they will have to give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. For this is the reason the gospel was preached, even to those who are now dead, so that they might be judged according to men in regard to the body, but live according to God in regard to the Spirit." What we're going to do tonight is we're going to look at it in two sections. Firstly, we're going to look at the chapter 3 section, and we're going to look at what Peter says about seeing Christ's suffering rightly. And then we're going to look at the chapter 4 section and see how Christ's suffering this way should make us see our own suffering rightly. The two things are connected. So first, seeing Christ's suffering rightly. And the first thing we see as we look at this passage, actually, is it doesn't give us any imperatives, does it? As you look through, there's no commands.
In lots of parts of Peter's letter, he's been telling Christians, do this, do this, do this, don't do this, don't do this. In this section, he's just describing things about Jesus and about what Jesus has done. And so what he's trying to do is he's trying to teach people more about Jesus' suffering, Jesus' death. That's what he's trying to do here. And he starts off with a theme that we've explored quite often in this book, verse 17. It is better, if it is God's will, to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. Straight off the bat, there's a lesson for us as Christians there, that there should be a willingness in us as a Christian to suffer for doing simply what we think is right in God's eyes. Suffering should not be enough of a reason for us to say, no, I won't do it. Why? Verse 17, for Christ died for sins once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. And the next few verses are all about Jesus' suffering, specifically his death. But straight away he's saying, Jesus suffered for you. And so are you willing to suffer for doing what is right under Christ? He's done that. How do you think about your suffering compared to that? For Christians at this time, you might think, well, why does he need to talk about, you know, Jesus' death? Aren't they familiar with this? But for Christians at that time, they're weak, they are insignificant, they are a tiny minority, they are vulnerable, they're easily picked on, and they follow a man who was crucified by the Romans, and nobody gets why that's a big deal. People might have said to them, well, you know, I heard about the Jesus of Nazareth guy, but, I mean, didn't it all end right when it was going to get interesting? He got to Jerusalem and people were excited about him, and I'd heard about the miracles and I'd heard about the authority that he taught with, and then he died. And his followers, what did they do? They were just left stuck, didn't know what to do next. He died as a criminal. I mean, the Romans don't crucify just anybody, do they? He had a criminal's death. Could he have been that big a deal? People would have looked at this Jesus of Nazareth that the Christians worshipped and called God and say he's utterly unimpressive. And his death is his low point, his defeat, that moment when he's going to be, you know, blotted out of the history books. So what's the big deal about his death? And Peter says it's totally, totally different. And these verses really unpack Jesus' death and Jesus' suffering to death in a way that we can't explore fully, but we're going to skate over. And the first thing that we see here is actually that Jesus' suffering to death was not deserved, but given. I struggle to know what words to use there, but the point I'm trying to make is that Jesus didn't deserve the suffering that came on him, but he gave himself to that suffering. He took that upon himself. It was sort of, he volunteered it almost. And we see that in verse 18. Have a look at verse 18. He had the criminal's death, but it wasn't deserved. Actually, he was the righteous one that didn't deserve to suffer, but he died the death of the unrighteous, the righteous for the unrighteous, verse 18. We deserved that. He didn't. And in the context of 1 Peter, it's worth stopping and noticing that actually Christians at the time of 1 Peter, they're suffering a lot, and often it's completely unfair. When we suffer and we deserve it, it's easier to take. When you suffer and you know you don't deserve it at all, it's completely unjust. That's a lot harder. But straight away, Peter is pointing to the fact that Jesus suffered unjustly. If he suffered unjustly, what should that say about how we're willing to suffer? Are we only willing to suffer when there's good cause and we brought it upon ourselves? When Jesus suffered, Jesus' death, Jesus' suffering was not deserved. He didn't deserve it. But although it was unjust, his suffering, and undeserved, it was not futile. It was not futile, but it was purposeful. Because have a look at verse 18 again and look what's achieved through Jesus' death. Through this suffering, Peter says, Jesus' death brings you to God. You who are by nature cut off from God and under judgment because of your sin are now brought back to him and brought into relationship with him. It's a fundamental change of your very nature. The very core of who you are is transformed by this death. So it's not a futile thing. The non-Christians at the time be like, well, that was pointless. It was all going well and now, done. No, it's not. It's a massively purposeful thing. It achieves something
astonishing for those who put faith in him. It kickstarts everything, actually. And far from this being his moment of defeat, it's actually his moment of victory. Have a look at verse 18. Although Jesus died in the body, it says he was made alive in the spirit. His death was an end of sorts in the sense that his body really did die. He really did die. But through that exact same action, he was made alive. And so as we look at this and we look at Jesus' death through Peter's perspective here, we say, actually, this is not so much about death and an end of things as it is about life and a beginning of things. The exact same event can be seen in a totally different way. And Peter carries on, and he goes into verses 19 and 20, and these are the really, really tricky verses right here. And the reason they're tricky, I mean, there's lots of reasons why they're tricky. The structure is tricky, the language Peter uses is tricky. But the main thing I think that makes it tricky is Peter is assuming a whole bunch of background knowledge his readers have that we simply don't have. You'll see a mention of Noah and the flood, and you might think, let's look up Genesis quickly. But actually, Peter isn't quoting Genesis here. He's referring to kind of the Noah tradition, almost the Noah folk tale that was known all across the cultures at that time. The Romans were very familiar with the Noah kind of folk tale. And what Peter is doing here, he's not preaching Old Testament. He's referring to a story that everybody knows. But it's a story that the details of which we've lost since. You can dig into and kind of dig in and think, I think he's saying this, I think he's saying that. We don't have the time to do that. But that's one of the big reasons why it's tricky. And so we want to ask questions like, well, who did Christ preach to? And when did he preach to them? And what's going on there? You know, what's prison? What's this? What are the spirits? And, you know, people have speculated over that. We're not going to go into that. What I want us to see here is the nature of the message that is proclaimed to these spirits. These rebellious, disobedient spirits are proclaimed a message of Jesus' victory over evil and death. Broad strokes, that's what we see happen here. And there's a timelessness to Jesus' victory here. Verse 19, verse 20, there's a timelessness to Jesus' proclamation of victory. That full and final judgment where sin is defeated and the devil is broken and everything that rebels and disobeys God is beaten happens at this cross, happens at Jesus' death here. And so as we look at these passages and we apply the broad strokes, which we need to do, we see that Jesus' death is not about defeat, but it's about victory. And through that victory, people are saved. If we take the language of Noah and you think about the story of Noah, you know what happens. It's about judgment, isn't it? People disobeying and rebelling against God and judgment falling on them. And yet, verse 20, in the ark, 8 people are saved. And so as Peter refers to Noah and the judgment and people being saved, and he's doing this in the context of Jesus' death, he's saying that Jesus' death is about both judgment and salvation. The two go hand in hand. As we look at Jesus' death, we're looking at judgment at the same time as we're looking at salvation. He talks about people being saved. He ties it to baptism, but he's clear to say that baptism isn't the thing that saves people, because the end of verse 21, he says, this saves you by the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who now has gone into heaven and is at God's right hand, with angels, authorities, and powers in submission to him. And so Peter, really, as he looks at Jesus' death, that people would sneer at and say, no, that was Jesus' defeat. That's weak, that's insignificant, and that has no meaning for anybody. Peter says, no, it's totally different. Christ's suffering, Christ's death, is totally different. It's not about what he deserved, because he deserved not to suffer like that, but he went to that suffering willingly. It's not futile, but purposeful, and it achieves something astonishing. It's not about death and the end of things, but the beginning and the start of things. And it's about victory. It's about glory. And look where it results. Verse 21. Think about how people might have seen Jesus of Nazareth. He's going to be forgotten in a few years. Crucified on a cross, he'll be forgotten in a few years. Trust me. And now verse 21. Look where Jesus is now, because of his suffering, because of his death. 21, he is now raised from the dead. He is glorified. He is put up in front of, he's put with authorities under him, powers in submission under him at God's right hand. There's no greater position of power. And he's there because he was willing to suffer, even to death. Peter wants his readers here to see the significance of Jesus' willingness to suffer, what it leads to, what it results in, what it achieves. He wants them to get that. Elsewhere in his letter, Peter talks about the suffering of Jesus, and it's kind of just more suffering. But here, there's a specific suffering to death. It's not just willing to have a tough time, it's willing to give your life as well. Suffer in this life to the point where you lose it. And that's what Peter is really pointing to here. Jesus did not shy away from that, did not shy away from that suffering. But ultimately, that suffering, that death, was a moment of life, of victory, of glory. And he wants his readers, and he wants us here tonight, to remember that and to see that. Because he wants us to have the same attitude towards our own suffering. 4 verse 1, he clicks it and he connects it to us very deliberately. And if you forget anything else in this passage, and you forget and you get muddled over all the details, do not miss the one imperative in this passage. In 4 verse 1, where he says, arm yourselves also with the same attitude. Since Christ suffered in his body, arm yourself with the same attitude. The one command you're getting tonight is to have this attitude towards your own suffering. That's the one command we're getting tonight. We have to take that. That's the plain thing here. And so it needs to be the main thing for us tonight, doesn't it? So let's think about how we see our own suffering rightly. Therefore, since Christ suffered in his body, arm yourselves also with the same attitude or the same way of thinking. 4 verse 1. It's important that we connect those two things together, Jesus' suffering and our own. How often can we comfortably talk about Jesus' suffering? Because it's familiar to us. Yeah, I know Jesus suffered for me. He died for my sins, and I'm grateful, and I know that. Jesus achieved something when he suffered. Yes, I know that. I believe that. And then act like our suffering's in a different category. No, I'm not willing to suffer in that way, because I don't see how good will come from it. Oh, yeah, good came from Jesus, but I don't think good would come from me suffering in this way. Or we look at people that we love that are Christians and we see them suffering and we really struggle with it and we distance ourselves from all the things that we know about Jesus' death and Jesus' suffering and the good that was achieved through that, and we somehow separate the two out. Peter here doesn't want us to do that. He wants them to be closely connected, really tightly connected, for us to think this way about Jesus means to think this way about suffering in our own lives, even suffering to death. We have to connect those two things. In 4 verse 1 at the end, he talks about the person who has suffered in his own body being done with sin. And the sense of that verse is of somebody who has decided to do what is right in God's eyes, even if it makes them suffer. If somebody gets to that point where they say, I'm going to do what's right in God's eyes, regardless of what the consequences are, they have made a clean break with sin. Not in the sense that they, that's Wayne Grudem's language, they've made a clean break with sin, not in the sense that they never sin ever again, but they see suffering, they see comfort in a totally different way, because their motivation is not simply to avoid suffering in life, to avoid, you know, to gain comfort, it's to do what is right in God's eyes, even if it makes them suffer, to make choices in this life based on what God wants, what you believe the will of God is. And that might mean sometimes making a decision that really literally puts you in a position of financial insecurity. And you don't know how you're going to pay the rent the next month, or you don't know how you're going to pay whatever it might be. It might be making a choice that is deliberately making yourself socially unpopular. Not because you want to be socially unpopular, but you want to do what is right in God's eyes, and you know that's a consequence of it. But the idolatry of social popularity is below the desire to do God's will in your own behavior, in your own attitude, because you are arming yourself with the same attitude as Christ towards your suffering and your comfort. If we act like this, it's going to lead to our Christian friends, non-Christian friends and family, thinking we're insane.
They will not understand what we're doing. They will ask us questions and be puzzled by what we're doing in a probably a hostile way, given the kind of context of 1 Peter's kind of language of questioning people questioning the Christian. They will not understand what we're doing. But because of the faith of a Christian, their life is lived in a completely different way. Have a look at 4 verse 2. This person, this Christian who has a different, has the same attitude as Christ, has suffered in his body, is done with sin. As a result, he does not live the rest of his earthly life for human desires, but rather for the will of God. The Christian who sees their own suffering rightly does not live for their own desires, their own earthly, human, evil desires, but lives for the will of God. And we have to stop here and ask ourselves the question, what are you living your life for right now? What is the primary motivating factor in the decisions you make, small, big? What was the last decision you made that was deliberately about avoiding suffering, about gaining comfort? What was the last decision you made because you thought it was what God would want you to do? We thought last week about honoring Jesus, didn't we? Because the person, the Christian who has had this attitude towards suffering and has broken with kind of the worldly way of doing things, has made a clean break and has a different pattern of how they analyze things and see things. And there's a sort of a difference in their life. Have a look at 4 verse 3. It talks here about somebody who's rejected an old way of life. It says this, "For you have spent enough time in the past doing what pagans choose to do, living in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and detestable idolatry." Sometimes I can look at verses like this, and because I grew up in a Christian at home, I don't have a time where I can look back on and I can say, yes, that's the old me and now I'm different. But this instead is a list of what I would otherwise be, who I would otherwise be. And the challenge to those who have left that life behind and have started something new is to say, look what you are no longer. But the challenge to someone who hasn't left that life behind, it should be, are you clearly not those things? Are you clearly something different to something you would otherwise have been if Jesus hadn't stepped in and done something? There's a pattern of life. And we might look at it, we might think, well, that's extreme stuff, isn't it? I mean, look at the list of things, debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, detestable, idolatry. We might think that's extreme kind of stuff. And I haven't, you know, my life was not like that before. And, you know, maybe I wouldn't be as good as I am now, but I certainly wouldn't be doing this kind of stuff. But actually have a look at 4 verse 4. It's really normal stuff. Because what's the reaction of people around them when the Christian doesn't join in? They think it's strange that you do not plunge with them into the same flood of dissipation, and they heap abuse on you. The non-Christian doesn't act like these things are extreme. They're not like, oh, let's go and murder a few people. Oh, you don't want to come? Okay, I get it. It is a little bit extreme. They don't understand why people don't want to join in. These things that they do are normal, are everyday. And as we look at them, and actually we think, well, what are the sexual ethics of our society? Are they really any different to this? People's attitudes towards sex and relationships. I could point any number of TV trailers for different programs I've seen on the telly recently. I won't mention them because I don't want you to look them up if you don't know about them because they're filth. There's any number of things I could point you to say, well, look at the state of the sexual ethics of our country. Our attitudes towards drink and our attitudes towards all sorts of different things. Consider the idols of career and lifestyle and image that people chase after constantly and don't bat an eyelid at. Normal. It's really weird if you don't join in, isn't it? Peter here is saying this should not be you, Christian, not anymore. Not if you're seeing your own suffering, your own comfort in the light of the suffering and death of Christ. Something that is directly connected to and influenced by the suffering and death of Jesus. Just think for a moment. When was the last time you made a decision, you did something, and you had to explain it to your non-Christian family or your non-Christian friends, and it was really awkward?
and you wished that no one would even bring it up. They just don't understand. Why aren't you coming? Why aren't you coming on Sunday morning? I don't get it. They're going to be offended if you don't come. Why are you not coming? Just come. Can't you skip churches one time? Have another drink. Have another drink. Everyone else is doing it. It doesn't matter. You haven't got work in the morning. Whatever it might be. Have you had those conversations? You're trying to raise your kids in a certain way and you don't want them to be part of that club and you have to tell someone why you're putting them out and you know it's going to be awkward. When you're at work and there's pressure to tweak that report and to make it seem better than it really is, and you know everyone in the office is going to hate you if you're honest. When was the last time you had those moments when you felt the awkwardness of that and you deliberately chose the thing that you knew was going to make you unpopular or the thing that you knew was going to jeopardize that promotion, maybe jeopardize that job, but you knew it was the godly thing to do? We should all have moments like that as Christians. I think this passage, that's a lesson here. We should all have moments like that. If we haven't had a moment like that in a long time, or we've never had a moment like that, it might be that for verse 2, we are living our lives for human desires rather than for the will of God. That might be what's going on. I think that as we sum up this passage, this little section especially, I think the Christian should be somebody who clearly knows something no one else does. Imagine you're at a dinner party and you're just there and it's amazing food and each course is just so, so good and you came hungry. And the first kind of nibbles came round and, little platters with little things on there. Everything that came around was just really good. And you had one of these and you had one of those. Thank you very much. And you're eating all of these things and you're getting more and more full. But the food right in front of you is so good and you just have to keep going. And then the starter comes around and the starter is amazing. And so, yes, please, I'll have seconds. Yes, please, I'll have thirds. And you're getting fuller and fuller. And then you notice the person sitting opposite you has barely touched their food. Barely touched it at all. I think it wasn't. That's a bit rude, isn't it? It's a bit rude. They're not hungry. Maybe they're not hungry. But I mean, they're saying all the right things, and so you just think, well, I'm going to eat it more for me. And you keep on going. And it gets to the main course, and you're getting really full at this point. But the main course comes, and it tastes amazing. And so you shove what you can down. You're forcing it down because it's there, and you have to have it, and it tastes good. And so you shove it down. But at the point where you're really sick, and you simply can't eat another bite. The person opposite you has just had a small bit. Thank you, that was really nice, and has just left it. I think, oh, right, I'm uncomfortable now. And then people start talking about dessert. You think, oh, I can't eat another bite. And then the dessert comes out, and it's this astonishing thing made by, say, your favorite chef is Heston Blumenthal. I don't know if you have a favorite chef, but imagine Heston Blumenthal is your favorite chef. And he's made this huge meringue castle thing with fountains coming out and strawberries and meringue and all this kind of stuff. And you come out, and you think, I've always wanted to have a dessert made by Heston Blumenthal. Always, always, always. My favorite chef. And now he's made this, and I'm so full I can't even eat it. And meanwhile, the person opposite is tucking in. And then you realize, oh, they went to the loo earlier, and they walked past the kitchen, and they saw what was coming for dessert, and they held back, knowing what was coming. They knew something I didn't know, and it totally changed the way they treated every different course that came. They knew there was something amazing to come. And so they held back. I thought it was weird. I thought they were being rude. I didn't understand what they were doing. This is good. If it's good, eat it. Why are you not eating it? You're weird. And yet, they knew something that I didn't. And there's a sense to which the whole Christian life should be like that. Christians living a life knowing something nobody else knows. Having that knowledge and living out a way in a way that shows we know something different about life, about death, about suffering. Because we know Jesus. And we know what can happen through suffering. We know what can be achieved. We know what it can lead to, what it has led to in Jesus. The instinct of the rest of the world is just to take what's good right now, to make decisions that keep suffering at arm's bay, at arm's length, bring comfort closer. That comfort doesn't last, and so you grab something else. Do what makes you feel good right now, like somebody at a dinner just shoveling everything that tastes good into their face, regardless of how they feel, regardless of what's to come. But what's to come is worth being aware of. Verse 5, verse 6 starts to talk about judgment language. Again, we've had judgment language in the Noah story, and here Peter brings it up again. These people that just live for all the glories and all the comforts of this life and try to avoid suffering, verse 5, will have to give an account to him who's ready to judge the living and the dead. There is a judgment to come. The death that we die in this life is not the end. It's not the worst thing that can happen to us. Verse 6 speaks of the value of the gospel being preached to those who are now dead. And Peter wants his readers to realize the fact that they're now dead doesn't mean the gospel has like failed on them. No, they've received the gospel. They have died in the body, but what has happened in the spirit? They have gained life by the Spirit. Think of the parallel with Jesus. Think of what that means for how we should treat our own deaths. There is a greater fate than death that we should fear, and that is the judgment of God. Remember what we looked at in chapter 3, the imagery of the flood coming and wiping out rebellion, wiping out disobedience against God. That was a picture of the judgment that is to come. 4 verse 7, we're going to look at this next week. Peter talks about the end of all things being near. The end of all things is what looms over us. And in the midst of that judgment is salvation, is an offer of salvation through the Lord Jesus. In the same way as in the flood, there were those 8 that were saved in the ark. In the same way with this judgment that is going to fall, there is an offer of salvation through the cross. And so as we consider God's judgment and we see the reminder that God's judgment is real, we must ask ourselves, are you included in the salvation plan? The judgment is going to come. It will be the end of all things. Are you amongst the minority that are in the ark? Those that are saved through the salvation plan that God offers to you in the Lord Jesus. When you look at the cross, do you see what should have happened to you happening to Jesus? Do you see the righteous for the unrighteous? The death of God himself to save a broken sinner? Is that what you see? Is that what you believe in? Because the cross of Jesus, the death of Jesus, isn't just about salvation. It's very easy. We like talking about that side of it, but it's also about judgment. Is it Jesus taking the penalty for our sin on himself and suffering what we deserve to suffer? If you're not a Christian, that's the question for you. Are you included in the salvation plan that God offers in the midst of his judgment plan? But if you are a Christian, just consider for a moment, what difference does knowing the judgment is real make to how you're going to live this week? When you consider the judgment that has fallen on Jesus and the pain it caused him, how is that going to affect how you see your chase after anything that prevents you from suffering? How is that going to affect your desire to get what is just makes you comfortable? There are a lot of questions that this passage throws out, but I think the big thing is this, for Peter to show us Christ's suffering to death once more, to unpack it, to just shine another light on it to make us see how astonishing it is and just what is achieved through it, and then to carry it over to the Christian, to you and me if you're a Christian, and say, Jesus did this for you. Jesus' suffering achieved this for you. Jesus' suffering resulted in this for the world. Now, what are you going to do with the times when God calls you to suffer? Is your attitude going to be, no, I'm going to avoid suffering at all costs? Or are you, 4 verse 2, going to live for the will of God rather than for evil human desires? We started off tonight asking the question, when was the last choice you made, the last thing you did simply to avoid suffering? As we look at Jesus' willingness to suffer for us and consider what his suffering and his ultimate death achieved for us, how does that make you feel about suffering for him? How does that make you feel about giving your life, literally dying for him? Let's pray. Lord Jesus, we see once again, we have once again a kind of a spotlight shone on your suffering and your death. This thing that seems so insignificant and so small to people just out and about in Chiswick at the moment, they don't get what the big deal is. And yet we thank you that this passage shines a spotlight on it and just once again shows us just how incredible what you did for us is. We really pray that you would protect us from being people that rejoice in what you did for us, but are slow to think that we should do anything for you. Help us to be willing to give everything to you, to sacrifice our comforts, to sacrifice our lives for you, because we know there is a fate worse than death, and we know there is a glory and a majesty and a blessing that is greater than anything that this life can offer us, in store for us in heaven. Help us to think rightly. Help us to have the same attitude as Christ towards suffering, towards comfort, because we long to be more like him. Amen.